Well, good morning. When the preacher goes long, we don't have enough time to talk. I'm sorry. That guy, I knew he was going to do that today. Deuteronomy 15 is where we're going to pick up this morning. Thank you for your presence. 15, 16, and 17, if we can get through it today. Here in Deuteronomy 15, he's talking about, first of all, the remission of debts every 7 years. This is an interesting law that God built into that society that I think is another indication of God's concern for the poor, for, you know, just how is he going to handle that in that society? This is a law that's both religious and civil. And how do you handle poor? You always got poor people, and how do you handle it? And so this was one provision he had. Deuteronomy 15, verse 1, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission of debts. This is the manner of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor, and he shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. From a foreigner you may exact it, but your hand shall release whatever of yours is with your brother. Okay, so again, this is how God demanded that the Israelites treat each other. God had made a law back in Exodus 23, verses 10 and 11, and also Leviticus 25, that every seventh year they would not plant crops. Let the land lie fallow. And so you plant crops for 6 years. The seventh year, you don't plant crops. And then whatever came up that year, you know how stuff just comes up volunteer. Whatever came up, poor people could just come and just eat that. You know, it's not stealing. That was the provision God made. Just come and eat that and that sort of thing. So let the land have a Sabbath to the Lord. And then also with that is the seventh year would be your release from all your debts. And so that would prevent someone getting trapped in a cycle of just lifelong, you're in debt forever and you can never get out of it. Every seventh year, at least, you're free from your debts. Now, some commentators suggest that this remission was not a complete remission of debts, but it was just like you had the seventh year off from payments. You didn't have to make payments the seventh year because people weren't planting crops the seventh year. You couldn't make a profit and pay, and so you just had the seventh year off, and the eighth year it would resume back again. I'm not sure that's what it's talking about. It sounds just like just remission of debt. Just the whole thing is gone. The debt is erased. That's what it sounds like to me. So anyway, and then in verse 4, however, there will be no poor among you. Now, what does he mean? Because the rest of the chapter he keeps talking about, here's how you treat the poor. What does he mean in verse 4 then? There will be no poor. Well, I think he just means there's provisions that he's making us all for handling the poor. And this is one of them, is you release their debts every 7 years and so forth because of the Lord. First of all, he's going to give them prosperity. And so in verse 4, there will be no poor among you since the Lord your God will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. So first of all, God's just going to make them prosperous. As they're obeying him, the crops are going to do well, things are going to flourish and be prosperous. And so that's the first provision. And then secondly, God is baking into their society the fact that they're all supposed to be generous to the poor, to each other, and to the poor especially. Verse 7, if there's a poor man among you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns, in your land, which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your brother, but you shall freely open your hand to him and shall generously lend him sufficient for his need and whatever he lacks. So there again is God's concern. You see that, by the way, all through the Old Covenant, God would make little provisions. You see little phrases. Here's the poor, here's the widow, here's the orphan. And these are provisions that were especially for them. And then in verse 9, beware that there is no base thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of remission is near, and your eye is hostile toward your poor brother, and you give him nothing. Then he may cry to the Lord against you, and it will be a sin to you. Okay, so you can understand how that would come up. You know, it's the sixth and a half year, and, you know, would I lend to my brother who's in need if I know it's about to be forgiven in a few months? And he said, don't do that. Don't have that attitude. You just take care of each other. That was God's plan. How often they did that, I do not know. He also told them not to worship idols. They did that all the time. So I don't know how often, how many of them did this, but this was God's intention for each other. It reminds me of Luke 6:35, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And so we have this new covenant version of that, of just do good. Just do good. And not because you're going to try to get something back or out of it, just go out and be good neighbors. Let's do verse 11, and then I'll stop for comments. Verse 11, for the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. And so again, as long as they obeyed God, as they're fulfilling these laws, then the poor are going to have handouts all the time. Every seventh year, their debt's forgiven. You know, these things are going to just be kicking in all the time as they're generous toward each other. Now, if they stop obeying God's law, all that goes away, which is just, there's trouble anytime we stop obeying God's law. And here's just one example of that. The poor would really be poor. They'd really be destitute if people stop being generous and lending to each other. So God is making provisions here to help with that. Insofar that they obeyed him, things would go well. And I think it's just another sign of God's love in the way he set that up. Okay, let me stop there. Comments, questions on any of that? Kind of interesting the way that God set that up. Kaylin?
Freely of your view to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. Okay. That makes me think of the phrase, duties are based on relationships. It's because it's their brother.
Okay.
He's not really saying give to every single poor person. It's the priority is your brothers first. Those, your people. And I think we see that in the New Testament with giving to needy saints, that
okay.
They're the priority. You take care of them first.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, as far as church work is concerned, you see the pattern in the nine New Testament passages where they were giving to needy saints. A Christian in general gives to everybody, Christian and non-Christian, so there's a distinction there. And yeah, maybe that is kind of an echo to what's going on back here, where these are rules for their fellow Hebrews and for this nation to stay the way God wants it to be. Okay? Anything else? JD?
It's really important. It says, your heart should not be grieved when you give to him. He's talking about when they would actually do the thing they were supposed to do, they still weren't pleasing if their heart wasn't in.
Okay.
Makes me think about the rich young ruler and all the commands that he kept. The omitted one was, you shall not covet. And Jesus told him, go sell what you have and give to the poor. That was the problem that he had, was he coveted his own goods. And that's what these people would be doing if they were grieved when they did the deed they were supposed to do.
Okay.
That's a great point. I didn't think to bring that out, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Just again, we notice, we've been doing that through Deuteronomy. Don't think old covenant was external. God didn't care about sincerity or the heart. That just came in the new covenant. It's way back here in the old covenant. It's just another example of that. God's looking at their heart and their attitude through that. Yeah, good example, JD. Something else I was going to say. It blew my mind. Happens sometimes. All right, Wyatt.
Think of if you end up thinking it was only in the new covenant that God looked at the heart is when, before David was appointed king, I don't, man may look at the outward appearance, but I look at the heart.
Okay.
1 Samuel 16:7.
Yeah,
when he's selecting David as the next king there. Okay. I remember what I was going to say. These people, just in general, were not living as high on the hog as we are today. I mean, we're just so prosperous today compared to just the average person back then. And yet, of course, still was this command to give. And we might say, well, I'll give when I have X number of dollars in the bank and I've got so much security. You know, they're living much closer to the poverty line, if we want to word it like that, than most of us will ever be, and yet there's still this generosity and the attitude, as J.D. pointed out in verse 10, that needs to go with it. Okay, anything else? Okay, if a fellow Hebrew hits rock bottom, let's look at verses 12 through 18, where really he's talking about slavery. You have to sell yourself into slavery. Verse 12, if your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. It shall come about if he says to you, I will not go out from you, because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you. Then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant forever, and you shall do likewise to your maidservant. It shall not seem hard to you when you set him free, for he has given you 6 years with double the service of a hired man, so the Lord your God will bless you in whatever you do. Okay, so here's another provision. If the handouts God had instructed them to give in just general generosity, if the seventh year remission of debts is not enough to keep one out of debt, if somehow they get in a situation where they're just in debt, you could work it off and become a slave to a fellow Hebrew and work off your debts. In Exodus 22, it mentions a case where somebody might commit a crime and he steals so much and then he can't afford to make restitution when he's busted. And there's another case where he might work it off through labor. And so when that was the case, God limited that to a temporary situation. 6 years, in the seventh year, you've got to go free. And then he said, when you set him free, you load him up with a whole bunch of stuff. Hopefully this guy does not turn into, you know, just the cycle of his life is going back into debt and so forth. Hopefully you set him up for success. And then the only option was, if he wants to stay, you can stay. Pierce his ear, and he can just serve you. If he likes the situation, he can just continue to serve you. Okay, comments, questions on that, verses 12 through 18. Tim?
I think one of the important parts here at the end of verse 14 is it's not just for those who are in need that this is happening. It says, or you shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. That's a reflection and a remembrance for these people. Look at all that I do have, kind of what you were saying a minute ago, but how liberal has God been to you? Now you go do the same.
Okay.
And again, we can see that in the New Testament as well, these reflections.
Yeah, exactly right.
Okay, and he's constantly reminding him. We see that again in verse 15. You were a slave. This whole nation was slaves in Egypt. And so don't forget that. And so don't look down on somebody that has gotten into this situation. And you're going to help them out and send them out and load them up and that sort of thing. Okay? Ma'am?
He expects us to plan for giving to other people. Even like he did, this nation, they knew every 7 years they were going to have to do this and they had to plan for that. I just feel like he's so generous himself to the widows, to children, to the poor. If we're going to reflect him, this needs to be a part of our plan for our life.
Sure.
Is that we, I'm not really even thinking so much about people on street corners, but I'm just thinking about taking care of the people around us and, the,
okay.
And our brethren and our non-brethren.
Yeah. And you think about it.
2 Corinthians 8, as he's purposed in his heart, that idea of planning when giving in that situation there. And I think in general, God expects us to plan all parts of our service to him, giving and everything else, speaking nicely to our neighbor, everything else in his law, that this is what we're thinking about, studying, and trying to think about how we're going to do it and implement those things in our life. So giving would certainly be a part of that. And just from the practical standpoint, you know, if you don't set money aside, you know how it is. By the end of the month, you're gone. You say, where did it all go? So we just almost have to plan if we're going to be generous. Yeah, yeah. Good point. Okay. These last few verses here, 19 through 24, or 23, where the firstborn males belong to God. Just read verse 19. You shall consecrate to the Lord your God all the firstborn males that are born of your herd and from your flock. You shall not work with the firstborn of your herd nor shear the firstborn of your flock. And on it goes from there. So that goes back to the Passover feast, which we're about to talk about in chapter 16, where back in Egypt, in the 10th plague, God spared the firstborn. And so from then on, he said, well, the firstborn belongs to me then. And so you can redeem the firstborn, and there's special provisions for the animals, as he is referring to here. But that was God's view. The firstborn belongs to me. And so you see that popping up here in the way they would treat their firstborn animals. Okay, anything in chapter 15 before we look at the next one? All right, chapter 16 talks about three feasts, the three annual feasts that the Israelites would observe. So this is kind of a good way for us to just review kind of what they were doing every year. This is annual stuff that they would do three times a year. In fact, skip down to verse 16. So Deuteronomy 16:16. Three times in a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths. and they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. Okay, so here's these three annual feasts. Males were expected to go to, you know, by the way, you notice that language again, to the place where God has chosen. So the tabernacle, which ends up being the temple in Jerusalem over time, and commemorate these three annual feasts. So, I mean, even in the New Testament, you see Jesus, for example, making that trip to Jerusalem. The feasts are coming. Acts 2, the Pentecost. Lots of people have come into Jerusalem for that feast. And so you see that happening. All right, so let's look at each of these. First of all, you got the Feast of Passover, which corresponded also with the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So these kind of two go together. And by the way, it's kind of hard to keep track of these because they have different names. You got Feast of Weeks, also called Feast of Harvest, Feast of First Fruits, and in the New Testament, Pentecost, Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, called the Feast of Ingathering. So you read them, you think, okay, which one is that talking about? It's kind of hard to keep track of all the different names here. But now we're talking about the Feast of Passover, which also included, it's the same time as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let's just read the text here. Deuteronomy 16:1, observe the month of Abib and celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God. From the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of the land of Egypt by night. You shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and from the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to establish his name. You shall not eat unleavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. For 7 days no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory, and none of the flesh which you sacrifice in the evening of the first day shall remain overnight until morning. You are not allowed to sacrifice the Passover in any of your towns which the Lord your God is giving you. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name, you shall sacrifice the Passover in the evening at sunset at the time that you came out of Egypt. You shall cook it and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. In the morning you are to return to your tents. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it. Okay, so this is an annual commemoration of that 10th plague back in Egypt. In fact, if you want to put a marker in Deuteronomy, go back to Exodus chapter 12 or 11. Let's go to Exodus 11. And just notice, we're not going to read the whole thing, but in Exodus 11:1, now the Lord said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from there. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Okay, so this is back when the Israelites are slaves in Egypt, and God has chosen Moses to be their leader, and he's going to lead them out of Egypt. But obviously, Pharaoh is just not going to let these people go. It's his source of labor, and so he's being hard-headed. He disobeys God's requests. God is plaguing him with various disasters to force his hand, to force him to let them go. And so he's done it 9 times, 9 different plagues, and the 10th one is about to happen. And the 10th one's going to be the worst and the most tragic, and that God's going to kill all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. And so that's what this is talking about here. Drop down to verse 4. Exodus 11:4. Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I'm going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who's behind the millstones, all the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. Okay, so then this 10th plague is going to come. God's going to kill their firstborn, and you notice God is saying there's a distinction. Israel's not going to be come under this plague, and that was the case, as we saw with several other plagues. They had to prepare a feast. They had to use the blood as God specified. Look in chapter 12. Exodus 12 and verse 5, your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old, and you may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the 2 doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. And then in verse 12, for I will go through the land of Egypt on that night. I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So that's where you get the phrase or word, Passover feast. It's commemorating what's going on here. So Here's the Bible drill slides I give the kids. How could the people avoid the 10th plague? And it's put lamb's blood on the doorpost of the lynch. So this, what this guy's doing is painting the blood up there, all over there. I see the guy, by the way, inside putting his sandal on, because God says, when this happens, the Egyptians are going to say, get out of here right now. So get your shoes on, get everything ready to go, and this is about to happen. God said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Can't really see that font in that color. By the way, there's some parallels between the Passover feast, the Passover lamb, and Jesus later on. That, let me just give you these slides to think about. Of course, the Passover feast observed the night of the Exodus, when they're exiting Egypt, as we just read here in Exodus chapter 12. Jesus observed that Passover feast the night he was arrested. They came the first day of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Having arrested him, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest and so forth. So at that same time, that's when Jesus happens to be arrested. This, of course, is an Old Covenant memorial, and Jesus is observing that with his disciples in Luke 22. When the hour had come, he reclined at the table, the apostles with him. He said, I've earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. And then a few verses later, he institutes a new covenant memorial, which we have up here on the table, which is the Lord's Supper. So he took some bread and gave thanks and so forth, and he institutes the Lord's Supper, which is what we do now under the new covenant. And that's, by the way, how we knew it was unleavened bread. It was because it was that time when that's all they were allowed to have in the house. Israel's Passover, all the congregation of Israel are to celebrate this. And then our Passover. Interesting verse, 1 Corinthians 5:7. Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. You might remember 1 Corinthians 5, the context there about the discipline of the man who's committing fornication in the church there in Corinth. And he's making the analogy, you got to get the leaven out of the congregation. It affects the whole lump of dough. And he said, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. It's high time to get the leaven out, in other words. Unblemished, the male animal that they're supposed to use was to be unblemished. Jesus, of course, is our unblemished lamb, figuratively. The blood of Christ was unblemished because he never sinned. No bones were broken of that Passover lamb. And interestingly, Jesus' bones were not broken, which was unusual for someone who was crucified. Of course, they were saved physically by putting that blood on the doorpost. We're saved spiritually by the blood, that is the death of Jesus Christ. But, of course, you got to use the blood, apply the blood. So they had to put it on the doorpost. And, of course, we have to be baptized into Christ, being baptized into his death in order to take advantage of the sacrifice that was made for us. So some interesting parallels there between that Passover and Jesus and his sacrifice for us. Okay, comments, anything to say so far, sir?
Drawn from blood in our society. We go through training if we do any public work on how to deal with shed blood or whatever, blood-borne pathogens. But we need to stay in contact with that. That lifeblood that was in the Creator that was given on our behalf is why we are saved. And the further we get away from discussing sacrifices, the further we get away from truly understanding what it meant for a life to be given for us.
Yeah, that's a good point. I saw something on the internet a month or two ago where somebody said, why do we even have farmers anymore? Why don't you just go to the grocery store and get your... We forget where things are coming from. So, we go to the grocery store and get our meat and forget this is an animal, And here's the blood that was sacrificed. When they're cutting throats of animals, you can't escape the reality that's there and the sacrifice that's being made. And we're insulated from that. So that's a good point to make. Okay, anything else? JR?
When you were putting the parallels up there, between the Old Testament, New Testament, Christ's blood and the Lamb's blood, the other parallel that I saw when you were in the latter part of 15 where it talked about the animals and you're going to keep up with the firstborn and those are the ones going to be the ones you're going to sacrifice in these feasts. There's a lot of prep that goes into knowing which was the first goat, which was the first sheep from this ewe or from that goat, whatever it may have been. There was a lot of preparation on their part.
Okay.
And then I thought there's also a parallel when we look at what God had to prepare. Before we know the foundations of the world, He knew we were going to need a Savior. He knew he was going to need a chosen people to set up all these things so we could understand his will, his love, and his concern for us. God was preparing before he even created us for us. But he expected the Israelites to prepare to be acceptable to God, to be able to prepare their mind, their flocks, keep all that together. And I think today we're to be preparing our heart before we worship him, before we go to him in prayer. There's a whole lot that we need to be doing and focused on, whether that's understanding his word or just getting in the right frame of mind. I think it's just that serious because we see him doing it with the Israelites. We see him doing it. Doesn't seem to be that much different, except it's not as physical for us.
Okay. That's a good point. And with the Passover feast, you had the Passover feast was one day, the 14th, and then 14th of the 21st was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Israelites knew, you know, it's time for the Passover. The leaven's out of the house. You have this Feast of Unleavened Bread that's going to happen starting on the same day. And like I mentioned earlier, that's how we know Jesus used unleavened bread there for the Lord's Supper. That's the only thing that would have been around. I already clicked. Here's the next one, Feast of Weeks. Back in Deuteronomy, let's go back to that text, please. Deuteronomy 16, in verse 9, it's, you shall count 7 weeks for yourself, and you shall begin to count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, and you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. Okay, so as verse 9 says, they would count 7 weeks. So that's where you get the Feast of Weeks. And then the feast would be the next day. So count 7 days, and the next day is the feast. So the 50th day would be this feast. So sometimes it's called Feast of Weeks. And then it came to be called, in New Testament times, the Feast of Pentecost. Pentecost comes from Pentecosti, this Greek word, which means 50th. And that's where that comes from. So in Acts 2, when they're all in Jerusalem for the Pentecost, it's this one that they're talking about there. Also called the Feast of the Harvest, because it was an opportunity for them, a freewill offering. On top of all the other offerings they're always giving all the time. Here's another one from the first fruits of the wheat harvest, as Exodus 34 puts it. And then this third one mentioned is the Feast of Booths, which I think is interesting. Look down at verse 13, Deuteronomy 16, 13. You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you have gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat, and you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter and your male and your female servants, and the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who is in your towns. 7 days you shall celebrate a feast of the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce, and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. Okay, so after all the crops were brought in, they would celebrate this feast, so sometimes called the Feast of Ingathering for that reason. Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year when you gather in your fruit from the labors of your field, Exodus 23. Look back in Leviticus just real quick. Leviticus 23, why is it called the Feast of Booths or Feast of Tabernacles? In Leviticus 23 and verse 40, now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, palm branches and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall thus celebrate it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born of Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Okay, so they would go to Jerusalem. They would set up these temporary shelters, get some sticks or branches, and you set up tents, set up booths, tabernacles, and you're going to stay in that for a week. And that's going to remind you. You're going to sit there for a week and think about how your ancestors had come out of Egypt and they lived in tents. Yeah, I just think that's a neat thing that God wants them to do that every year. And this is how they commemorate that. So it's sometimes called Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, or in gathering for those various reasons. Okay, comments, questions on any of that? The rest of chapter 16, just kind of some miscellaneous laws. Wyatt?
And there in Leviticus, on verses 34 and again 39, it says that was to be the seventh month and starting on the 15th day.
Okay.
Just like it was mentioned in Deuteronomy that the Passover was going to be month one, starting day 14.
Yeah. There's a lot to keep track of. If you're an Israelite, there's a lot of these dates and everything that to keep track of, and every year to celebrate these. By the way, the Passover started with just everybody in their house would do it, but now in Deuteronomy, he mentions these are all three going to be in the place where God chooses. So now they're going to make the annual trek to celebrate these feasts. Oh yeah, there's my Bible drill for this one. Where did the Israelites live for 7 days? Booths. There's my tree branches. Okay, chapter 17. Let's move on. I think it's interesting, by the way, thinking about those feasts, that God, that probably says something about God knows our tendency to forget things. And God set up those reminders. Here's these annual feasts. Here's what you think about and talk about and what you're commemorating because he knows how we are. We need that. And, of course, in the New Covenant, we have the Lord's Supper, the first day of the week, that reminds us again of Jesus and his sacrifice. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 1, "You shall not sacrifice the Lord your God an ox or a sheep, which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God." So starts off with that principle, and you can find that throughout the Bible, this idea of you make sure your worship is acceptable, that you're doing your best to serve him. Malachi chapter 1 really talks about this, where they had not been doing that, and they're offering lame animals and blind animals and sick animals, and he says, you know better than to offer that to your governor. Why would you sacrifice that to God? And, of course, that gets back to probably greed and the money, because here's an old sick animal. It's probably going to die anyway. Might as well sacrifice it. And he said, no, I want your best one. Sacrifice that to me. And so it gets back to their attitude and how they revere God or do not. And then in verses 2 through 7, a very strict law. Anyone serves other gods, stone them. Look what he says here in verse 2, Deuteronomy 17, 2. "If there's found in your midst in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them or the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and if it is told you and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true and the thing certain that this is detestable, this detestable thing has been done in Israel, and you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is, to the man or the woman, and you shall stone him to death. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witness shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst." Hard to think of a more strict law than somebody goes to worship other gods, you have to kill them. And he said, your hand is going to be the first one. You're the witness. And so that would hopefully keep people from just lying. Somebody you don't like and you say, I saw him worshiping an idol. And hopefully their conscience would be such that they wouldn't want to. First of all, you have to have two witnesses at least. But secondly, their hand would be the first one and throw the first stone. So strict law. Last week we looked in chapter 13, which was similar to this. If someone's trying to seduce you to worship an idol, this is a little different. This is just saying if someone just worships an idol and you find out about it, this is what's supposed to happen. So in Israel, God's idea was not live and let live. He said, you see someone worship an idol, you find out of it, you inquire, you search diligently. If that's the truth, you take them out and stone them. Your hand is going to be first. So it's pretty strict. And God cared about their souls. He knew the tendency was that sort of thing starts and it spreads. And so you take care of this right then. And obviously, if that were to happen, I mean, fear to everybody else to not do that, not step out of line. And that was, I'm sure, part of God's reasoning here. You see that in other passages where that fear kicked in after discipline was invoked. Okay, let me pause there. Comments, questions, anything else to observe here? Sir?
Okay. Animal without blemish, you know, I mean, you think about a child who, like, has a pet, you know, that they're really close to, or we have an animal that, you know, we raised and all this. I mean, there's some, you know, pain that you go through to go ahead and have it sacrificed, but it's because of me. And, you know, then you think about, you know, Jesus was sacrificed for us. So that's what it's leading to. This is because of me, that I'm going to go through this pain.
Okay. I mean, the word is sacrifice. It, for a reason. This is something you're giving up that hurts to give up. And that's a good point. It's not just, I don't want it anyway. You're making a sacrifice. And that would be the case even with these animals back then. Okay? All right, look at the next section here, 8 through 13. Let's just read verses 8 and 9. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. So, all right, so again, this is religious law, but it's also civil law. So basically he's saying it's kind of like a Supreme Court system here. If there's a case is too difficult, it comes finally to the place where God chooses. Bring it to the tabernacle, ask the priest or the judge what to do about there. I'm sure God could intervene whenever he saw fit to provide a verdict in any particular case, but this is kind of the Supreme Court system that God was setting up for them. And then this last section is rules for future kings, which is interesting because God didn't want them to have a king. And yet he's saying, when it happens, these are going to be the rules for the kings. Look in verse 14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around you, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Okay, so he's saying, when you go into the land, and I know you're going to do it. I don't want you to do it, but... And by the way, there's a number of laws like that to the Old Covenant that are, some people call them contingency laws, which it's not where God wanted them to do it, but if and when you do, this is the next thing that needs to happen. So if and when you do make a king, here's the rules for the king. You see that here. 1 Samuel 8, that's where they say, give us a king. Samuel, the prophet's upset. God says, they're not so much rejecting you as they are rejecting me from being king over them. So we know God didn't want it, but here's the rules regardless. Verse 16, moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. All of those are pretty interesting laws, too. Given instructions that are maybe the opposite of what most of us would think, oh, this is what makes a good king. This guy needs to be rich, secure, powerful. Alliances all over the place, and the wives probably has to do with that. You know, marry a daughter of this king over here, you know, make all these alliances and multiply wives. God said, that's the opposite of what I want here. And by the way, maybe there's something for us to learn as parents when we're telling our kids what would be good for them as they launch out into the world. It's, you know, it's not go make all the money you can. It's certainly not go marry all the wives you can. But, you know, there's these different standards of what we think is successful. Here's a successful king. He says, not necessarily one who's rich and military alliances. Verse 18, now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. So think about what he's saying here. To these future kings, don't worry about amassing all this gold, silver, military alliances, going down to Egypt, all this. Don't multiply wives. You're going to turn your heart to idols. Solomon notoriously failed in that. Instead, he said, get your head in the book and the book in your head. I want you, and the interesting thing is, write. I want you to write a copy of this law in the presence of the Levitical priest there, which I love that that was God's command to them. The NRSV says, he shall have a copy of this law written for him. I don't know that that's accurate. The majority of translations make it sound like the king himself was to do the writing and that this is the law. He's making a personal hand, all they had was handwritten copies, but make a personal copy for himself that he's written, and that's it. I don't know if any kings actually did this or not. This was the law. I don't think we have a record of it ever explicitly being mentioned, but this was the law. I'm also not sure if this law is the book of Deuteronomy, or part of Deuteronomy, like chapters 12 through 26, where he's talking about a bunch of law stuff, or maybe the whole thing that was whatever was scripture at that time, kind of like Genesis through Deuteronomy, as we would call it today. Whatever it was, God says, I want you to write a copy of this law for yourself and follow. Verse 19, it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. In 2020, I preached a sermon from those phrases, a sermon about Bible reading. And you notice the benefits of reading Scripture all the time, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. So we learn about God when we read Scripture. Carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, so we learn to obey. That his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, so we learn a proper view of self and get some humility. That he may learn not to turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so we learn to avoid sin. So that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. We learn how to prepare for the future. So I love that section here. Write a copy of the law. Read it every day. I don't know how many kings, if any of them, ever did that, but that was what the command was. Okay, let me pause there. We've got some time to talk. Comments, questions about any of this stuff so far? Kaylin?
I think it's interesting that now we have a lot of studies about how writing helps you remember. Like, a lot of my professors encourage you to physically write things down just because you remember them better.
Okay, I saw something on YouTube the other day about that. Even the difference between typing notes and literally handwriting them, I don't know, something about our brain, it just helps you. So, now, I don't write much these days. I'm mainly typing, but they say it helps. Right.
Maybe it's the longer amount of time that it takes to do that, that the longer you have to see the text and the more it sticks in your
brain.
Think
about it. Something goes through your brain at a different, I don't know what the science is, but it's interesting. Sir?
I know somebody that does calligraphy, and they do verses.
Okay.
You know, and it really takes a lot of times, like almost like a painting or something.
Oh, yeah.
Slowly do that, and he would say that helped him memorize Scripture.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, sometimes the kids will bring me notes from a sermon, and they, well, a lot of times they'll write what's on the PowerPoint, which is really cool, but they will also draw pictures of, like, the point acted out. Like, here's me being nice to my neighbor or something, which that's my favorite because I'm thinking they're getting it, at least part of it, and they're thinking about what it looks like in real life. Really neat. Okay, anything else? JR?
He's talking there in 16 about, moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return to Egypt. And then 17, he's talking about the wives, which you said we're talking about, you know, making alliances, which was a common thing. But it looks like if you read over in Isaiah 31:1, where he says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. So it looks like 16 and 17 for sure that you were mentioning in Deuteronomy. It's all about that king is not to be trusting in the things of this world. You need to seek me. You need to trust in me. Don't be going trying to get a bunch of horses for your chariots and for your army. Don't be making alliances. It's still about seek me first, and I'll provide what you need. I'll provide the security you need.
That's exactly what it is. And a good reminder for us, that you think of 1 Timothy 6, don't put your trust in riches, but in God. Same idea as he's telling the kings here. Okay, let's cut it off today. Thank you for your attention this morning, and we'll pick it up next week, Lord willing.